Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Hello, everybody. We're running late. We're millennials. What are you going to do about it? There's still a few more millennials coming in, probably. Got coffees on the way. Yeah. Hi, and welcome to this Sydney Writers' Festival event. Thank you. My name is Sam Cooney, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here to this session, The Millennial Condition. I was actually wondering how I'd read that out, whether it was dun-dun-dun or uplifting, but I went down. Please excuse my voice. I'm a little bit husky after a couple of long days and nights. Before anything else, I would like to solemnly and fully acknowledge that we are here together on the land of the first and continuing custodians of this part of Sydney, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I think at an event like the Sydney Writers' Festival, especially, which is all about storytelling and communities, with many wide-ranging discussions about history and the future, that it's really particularly important to note that people have been doing what we're doing right here for tens of thousands of years before us. I offer my deep respect to Aboriginal elders past and present, and through them to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, especially any people here today. I would like to acknowledge that Indigenous sovereignty was never ceded of this nation and all of this continent and all of all the nations within, and that colonisation and its resultant genocide, cultural and otherwise, is a project that continues to this day. I would also like to thank, on behalf of Sydney Writers' Festival, the Culture Island and the Consulate General of Ireland here in Sydney. It is their support that allows Keelan Hughes to be appearing here today. So we're very lucky to have her. So today I'm supposed to be speaking to these three wonderful writers about the whole millennial thing. But you know, we're probably just chat about whatever we want because as millennials we're very easily distracted and we're very anxious and also incredibly entitled and selfish. We might even have a 5-minute break in the middle of the session so we can check our phones. Maybe one of you will have taken a photo of us and we'll have to repost it on Instagram with a couple of self-deprecating GIFs so people know we're proud but not too proud, you know. And we'll do what we want because we're too cool to care about what you think, even if later on we'll actually all have mini breakdowns back in our rooms because you all saw us for the imposters we really are. But that breakdown can't last too long because we've got deadlines and also 4 jobs each.
Oh.
But who knows, maybe, just maybe, real radical self-care is plunging oneself deeper into the gig economy. Maybe if we work just a little bit harder, then everything will turn out okay. So like I said before, my name's Sam. I'm a publisher at a not-for-profit literary organisation. We make books and a magazine called Lift a Brow. And I'm also a millennial, whatever the hell that means. It's my pleasure to introduce the panel to you all now. So we have Fiona Wright here, closest to me. Fiona Wright is an editor and writer and critic from Sydney. Her book of essays, Small Acts of Disappearance, won the 2016 Kibble Award and the Queensland Literary Award for Nonfiction. Her poetry collections are Knuckled, which won the 2012 Mary Gilmore Award, and Domestic Interior, which is shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Literary Award. And her new essay collection is titled The World Was Whole. We've both got it here. You will buy it afterwards. Next along here, we have Evelyn Araluen, a poet, educator and researcher working with Indigenous literatures at the University of Sydney. Her work has won the Nakata Brophy Prize for Young Indigenous Writers, the Judith Wright Poetry Prize and a Wheeler Centre Next Chapter Fellowship. Born, raised and writing in Darug country, she is a Bundjalung descendant. And last of all, we have Keelan Hughes, an Irish writer whose poetry collection, Gathering Evidence, won the Irish Times Strong Award. She has received many foundations, many fellowships. I hope you don't forgive me if I won't read them all out. And you've been published very widely. Keelan holds a PhD in English Literature from Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand. And Pulitzer Prize-winning author Anthony Doerr calls Keelan's debut novel, Orchid and the Wasp, a gorgeous novel told in an onrush of wit and ferocity, which will rattle your most basic assumptions about money, ambition, and the nature of love. Keelan Hughes is a massive talent, end quote. All right. So, I thought we might at the start even just try and have a bit of back and forth between ourselves, with you listening, obviously, about what we even might mean by millennials, because I think there's no point continuing any discussion if we don't even maybe have some kind of agreed upon understanding of the topic. It's not even really agreed upon which years bracket the so-called millennial generation. Some say it was 1980 to 2000, others say 1981 to 1996. The new millennial cutoff of 1996 is important because it points to a generation that is old enough to have experienced and comprehend 9/11, while also finding their way through the 2008 global financial recession as young adults. Many of the behaviours attributed to millennials are the behaviours of a specific subset of mostly white, largely middle-class people born between these years. But if you're a millennial who didn't grow up privileged, you've been impacted by the societal and cultural shifts that have shaped the generation anyway. So before I ask any other questions of each of you, what I would like to find out is what you even understand by the term millennials. What comes to mind? What is your experience with this terminology? So when I say millennial, what does this mean to you? Maybe Fiona, would you mind starting?
Okay, it's a big question.
Yes.
The working definition I have is a date-based one, which starts in 19 kids born in 1982 because they turned 18 at the turn of the millennium. That's how I've always understood it. But you might have noticed I groaned when Sam mentioned the gig economy. And that's because I have been up since 7:30 this morning and this is the third job I've done today. And it's a Saturday, which I think is quite instructive. I think all of us had kind of multiple jobs listed in our job titles. And to me, that's one of the kind of things that I think is most pertinent and pressing, that the conditions under which we labour have changed so much from our parents' generation, so much so that sometimes I have conversations with them that are kind of completely unintelligible to me. One of my jobs is casual teaching at a university, and you know, we had public holidays last week, and two of those were on days that I normally teach, and my mother was like, "Oh, but you're going to get paid anyway, aren't you?" And I was like, "No, I'm not working." And she was a casual teacher for a little while in the 80s. And she said, "Oh, we used to get paid on public holidays, even when we were casuals." And I was like, "Fancy that. Isn't that lovely?" How things have changed.
Isn't it lovely when the older generations just go, "Oh, really?
Yeah,
that
really?
That didn't happen to me." Oh, well, yeah. Ev?
I don't really identify with the idea of millennial, apart from that whole thing about the millennial pink colour. Really into that. There is just some little neuron that when I see that soft baby pink, I'm like, yeah, I need like a reusable water bottle in that colour. You know, my dad's a World War II baby. My mum is a boomer. I find that weird too. Don't worry.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I've kind of come into... I was born in 1993, so I've kind of... I'm fairly sure that I am a millennial in that sense of a temporal association. Not that I massively believe in time at this stage of my life and having an existential crisis over it, which is very millennial. But I feel like all of the different classifications of it are very much, you know, exist to me through irony and not through actual identification. I don't even really support the basic logic that a generational collective has any real relationship with each other. I think that the thing that is most looming and most collective for all of us is that we're all going to, in our lifetime, see the massive and devastating effects of climate change. That's kind of, I think that's just the reality that we share, but everything apart from that is just so disparate through wealth, class, gender, race. It's just a very confusing time to be told, "Oh no, but this is your favourite colour and you like avocados and that's why you
don't
have
avocados.
A house."
I just
put that out to start
up.
With. I hate avocados. They taste like snot.
I had a no avocado ban on my notes, but you've already broken it. So, yeah. I'm not sure if you know the avocado debate here, Keelan, and I don't want to get into it, so we'll talk about it later.
No, that is a trans hemisphere problem, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I actually never really thought about the millennial condition until I was staying in Dublin with my 51-year-old cousin. And he said, so, you know, yeah, your generation, you know, have you ever heard of the term snowflake? You know, it's just, it's so easy to offend you, you know, you're just, you want everything and you want to be able to, have permanent jobs immediately, and you change jobs every 2 years because you get bored. And, I was just gobsmacked at the fact that we're both cousins, you know, but within what I thought was, I suppose, a generation, there was an enormous difference in what we, in how we perceived each other. And I think the fact for him is that, you know, well, for my parents' generation, their house cost them 2 years of their salary. Yeah. And my house cost me 11 years of my salary. And that's the norm, I think, for our generation. Healthcare, housing, and education are three times more expensive now, relatively, than they were in the 60s. So, you know, it's a very clear difference as to whether or not what year, you know, the change happened when you could no longer expect to have a retirement fund, when you could no longer expect to have kind of any hope of getting tenure track or tenure at university. Mm-hmm. All of those things that started being eaten away at, you know, it probably didn't all happen in the same year. And I think that's what makes talking about the millennial condition kind of difficult. But if it's an excuse to talk about what's happened to our economy, then and to our lives as a result, then I think it's a worthy thing to bring us together.
And what is your reaction when someone like your 51-year-old cousin says something like this? Do you turn away? Do you fight back? Do you try and argue? Because it sounds like he's read an article that day, learned what snowflake means, and then feels like he can probably explain the whole world to you. But
probably an angry tweet, more likely.
A tweet, yeah. We'll talk about you and Twitter later, but was your reaction then, and is your reaction generally when, whether it's an individual, or you read an article, or you feel like just the world is telling you something about yourself, which you know inherently not to be true, or you know there's an inherent misunderstanding there, and you are just living the reality of, like I said, these pressures. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I'm still from a privileged position, which includes for me not having children, because then there are automatic obligations in that, and you never know what's going to happen. There's more risks. The statistics for risk goes up, I guess my initial response would be, Do I have the energy right now to try and start explaining and to try and talk this through? And is it being is the person on the other end going to listen? And if they're not, it's not worth it because you're probably worth three jobs that week. I think if it's people that you love and that you want to have a relationship with, then I find it very difficult to sit with somebody and know that we've got an enormous difference in ideology and carry along as normal. I kind of tend to, confront those things if I can.
Yep. Yeah. How about you too? Are you the kind of people to arc up, or are you just going to go and get in your Uber and drive them around instead? But
I have very limited energy. It's a fact of my life. I don't know. I really hate the snowflake argument. I'm someone who lives with chronic anxiety. You see, I've got a disability aide on stage with me here. But I also think, how could you not? In 90 days' time, I could be kicked out of my house in 90 days' time. I know that I have my main income, which is the casual teaching for the next 4 weeks, and then I don't know what I'm doing for money. My health isn't great. I challenge anyone to live under those conditions and not be anxious. It's systemic. I generally don't fight because I can't be bothered.
Yeah. I think that's happening more and
maybe
more.
Maybe that's millennial.
Case. Yeah, I think that's more and more the case. It could be said that the millennials or the millennial generation is also the knowledge generation, so that anything and anything we want to know and also don't want to know is right there in front of us and at our fingertips. Do any or all of you feel that burden, the burden that you should know more about everything that you have learned about, and even if you didn't want to know that thing existed, and you should know more about these things, and also that this information is thrust upon you every waking moment, whether you want it or not? Is this the burden of information and responsibility to know about especially the ills of the world? And we will talk about climate and things like that, but even, you know, when you learn about every disaster and every small and big important thing wrong in the world at any moment, as well as systemic, how do you kind of deal with that in your daily life?
Well, one of the things that's popping to mind is that can undermine your authority in any situation. You know, certainly when you're teaching, there is the feeling coinciding with, I suppose, a late capitalist problem in education, that there's a consumer culture in education. And so often a lot of your students are like, you're what I'm paying for, so deliver, you know. And if you kind of aren't able to say what year, you know, Keats died in, they can check under their phone on the table and then say he died and whatever, and make you look bad. but more than anything, it's, I think, and also it doesn't help being women when you're when you're teaching. You know, there's an automatic assumption that, you know, you need to be able to exercise your authority in some kind of a quantifiable way, and it's not, you know, something that would be taken as a given. The question was about...
You can learn about every atrocity, small or big, every cause that is there.
The other thing to say to that was, you know, analog culture was quite relaxing. I remember analog culture. Mm-hmm. There's less multitasking involved. Everything is physical. A book is a book that you get to the end of, you know. A conversation is a conversation that you get to the end of without kind of 100 distractions in between. And so it changes the way that you experience life, I think, the digital age, you know. Like, I have a meditation app on my phone, but I'm quite aware of the fact that the meditation app, its goal is to make me be more productive.
I hate that.
Yeah, it's to improve your productivity so that you can meditate right now, package that into a product, and then go and work like a worker wasp.
Yeah, a lot of self-care seems to be packaged and marketed around being better, little economic units, which is another whole problem unto itself.
Yeah, I went down a big research rabbit hole with that a few years ago. I got really interested in self-tracking, like bodily tracking apps, and this kind of quantified self movements, which is mostly a bunch of tech bros in the States. But I kind of went down that rabbit hole because I got a Fitbit, which was a really stupid idea for an ex-anorexic. Just putting that out there. I thought I was going to use it to limit my walking, but the whole thing's designed to, like, put you in competition with yourself. And I was like, oh, I can beat yesterday again.
Yeah.
It was really a poor idea. But, you know, this so much of the discourse around that is all about being a better worker, optimizing your body and optimizing your brain, and how to be more productive, as if that is your sole worth as a human being, what you can produce and what you can make in economic sense. And I kind of went down this little rabbit hole for quite a few months, and it was great fun, which is actually on point, because I think the thing that saves me from this knowledge overload
loop,
distraction, whatever, is my work as a writer, because the kind of research that I do and the kind of thinking that involves in the process of writing too, for me at least, requires a particular discipline and a particular focus, and I think that's a blessing. I think that's really, really, really fortunate, and I'm fortunate that I get to do that too, of course.
For me, I think with my work as a teacher, educator, researcher, the difficulty is that we're dealing with this time, yes, of an increasing pressure to know everything, or to at least superficially understand how all of these different global components work together. But I'm dealing with an area that is so visible and yet so so erased and so not understood. Like, so I teach a lot of introductory classes on Aboriginal culture, Aboriginal land management, Aboriginal history, and these sorts of things. And in that sort of context, my expertise is really coming from, yes, I've got experiences a researcher. Yes, I've got these degrees and I've got this knowledge behind me in an empirical sort of sense, but it's also that I have accountability and responsibility that's been given to me through the different layers of elders and community members, you know. So that question of, you know, are you a delicate little snowflake that we sometimes often get when we're working in increasing understanding of something that is really not understood and is still undergoing processes of oppression and erasure, and you're often very much told that you're exaggerating the issue. I operate to sort of, you know, the pressure that I have is essentially just to sort of like bleed and use that to demonstrate the effect of what I'm trying to make people understand. So I'm not just teaching through my expertise, I'm not just teaching through my knowledge of Aboriginal history and culture as an Aboriginal person, I have to demonstrate what's happened and how that has placed me in the positions that I'm in. And that, I think, is an emotional, you know, we talk about emotional labour, and I think it's not really understood as a concept, but it's very much this sort of overwhelming emphasis on myself as that sort of byproduct of these processes. And I don't really ever get the opportunity to actually talk about stuff that I am passionate about and that I know about and that I would really love to teach, because those are just not the hiring sorts of metrics that are going on right now.
Right. Mm. So, each of us here are very different people from very different backgrounds, but we're also miracles because all of us have the same two mothers. Mother Earth, of course, but also Mother Internet. So each of us has been raised and fed and taught and disciplined by Mother Internet. And so I'd love to hear, and we'll talk about social media, but also more generally, this digital age, and especially the digital age of the internet. As you've grown up, as children, as teenagers, and as adults, what has your relationship been like with the internet? But right now as well, what is your relationship with it? How do you use it, but also how do you block it out? And you talked a little bit about that, Fee. Megha Walitzer on stage last night in a group of six women talked about writing being the time when she can actually block out all the tweets and the Goodreads reviews and the Amazon reviews and the things that are always at the back of her head. But what is your relationship now with the internet?
I don't have email on my phone and have never done that and never will do that.
Yeah, right.
And I do try and write in spaces that aren't connected. You know, I write a lot in cafes. It's just always done, partly because coffee is amazing, but also because I work mostly from home, which is another kind of thing that I think is quite common, or more and more common for our generation too. So to kind of break up that space a little bit really helps me shift focus and shift headsets, especially because there's so many other jobs that I'm doing at the same time. But I really love being on the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like social media. I have a lot of friends who I first met that way. And it's also taught me a lot. It brought me into contact with a lot of people who I wouldn't have been brought into contact with otherwise. And part of that is the disability community, who really, you know, really kind of smart, engaged, interesting people, mostly active on the internet because access to public spaces is sometimes difficult for us for various reasons. And I wouldn't have been able to come to terms with my illness without that, I think. But also communities specific to my illness that use the internet in ways that it's not designed for. You know, there's a lot of posting photos of food, for example, but in a community of people with eating disorders, that means something very different. It's a type of solace, it's a type of connection, it's a way that we can encourage each other and help each other out. So I get very frustrated with the argument that social media is disconnecting us from each other and that it's not real, or that these virtual relationships aren't important or are kind of atomizing in that kind of way. I think it can bring you in contact with sort of special interest groups in a way that you might, that I think is a really kind of special thing. And it's been really, really important to me and really helpful.
And it just made me think you started a blog recently as well.
Oh, yeah.
Did you want to talk about that?
Yes, I started a cooking blog called Anxiety Baking, which is because I bake a lot when I'm anxious. And then I read this article in an American journal about how this is a thing that millennials are doing, anxiety baking. So it's just me taking photos of the stuff I bake and including the recipes, but also including kind of writing about the reason why I'm anxious. Because one of the things I was keenly aware of is the voice, and kind of I'm ambivalent about this language, but bear with me. The things that anxiety will say to you are sometimes completely ridiculous. Like one of them, I was really, really anxious because a colleague was going to call me, and I was like, why are you going to call me instead of sending me an email? And also I have 101 unread emails, or like, I'm really anxious because I have to teach tomorrow and obviously all of the students are going to hate me. And you know that that's complete rubbish, but it's, the voice is insistent and it's ridiculous, and it felt like a really good way to kind of expunge that, but also like make fun of it. And people seem to really like it.
They do, yeah. And I love how at the end you do give it a rating about how well it alleviates your anxiety.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And even sometimes it's like 4 hours of frittata and a brownies and I'm still at the
same
place.
Still fucking anxious.
But at least I've got this food. Does anyone want it?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's classic, you know, yeah. 8 years of therapy. You're always giving number values to your anxiety and whatever else. And it's...
Right.
Yeah, you know, let's quantify this very qualitative experience.
Yeah, exactly. I particularly think you're terrific at Twitter. Mm. Your threads I've saved as separate documents sometimes, as essays. And I thought for a long time, the last 2 or 3 years, that Twitter was just gone and dead and anyone doing anything good. But there seems to be some people pushing back again and using the form to do, short fragmented essay threads as well as reaching out to different communities. Do you do this? Is this through any particular drive or emotion, or is it something that you feel like is a responsibility, or is it a procrastination thing, or is it all of the above?
All of the above.
Yeah.
For me, Twitter is this place where I've just sort of told myself there are no repercussions, and that's constantly proved incorrect. I know so often that is not the case. But I found that, particularly for Aboriginal people, Twitter has been this like fantastic place for us to be speaking with each other and to be speaking politically and assertively about our identities and our experiences. Aboriginal people in particular, we actually are the highest users of social media in the country, and that is actually spread across all generations. We don't have those sorts of dynamics where you do have an older generation of non-Aboriginal people in Australia who might pick up social media once, but they don't tend to be consistently using it. For us, we use it because it's an extension of our kinship networks and it allows us to be communicating very extensively. But Twitter for me is a place where I feel like, because it's quite faceless, when I speak about stuff that maybe I don't really feel comfortable saying in front of like the kids I went to high school, I feel like I'm not so much on the chopping block there, and I can say things that are speaking more to my experience and my authority and my perception, as opposed to like, oh, it's that weird girl who threw her shoe in PE, that sort of dynamic. But it has also been really detrimental. And so, like, for example, a couple of years ago, a very, very dear friend of mine, there was an online sort of campaign attacking Ellen Van Nieuwen because some kids read her poem in their HSC exam and didn't like it. And suddenly that's my mate's Ellen's fault. People thought I was Ellen because I was sticking up for her. And so for about 2 weeks, I had people sending me photoshopped pictures of lynching victims with my face on it at 2 a.m. Like, I had people making videos about me on YouTube, calling me like the socialist professor, which was a career upgrade for me, actually.
It sounds like a great thing too.
I actually honestly didn't mind that part. So I'm not sure that the consequences are really weighed against the benefits, but I do know that my community's there and we're on there and we're using it so much. And if I can break down things to you know, now 280 characters, that's changed my Twitter style so much. If I can break something down into these sorts of segments, what it does hopefully is it gives a slightly better language for people to be making this point in a conversation or in an argument or something like that. I'm really steering away from the traditional essay structure, and I'd rather write personal creative essays. I would rather try to just keep my points to a really direct and useful sort of function so that hopefully something can be taken from them.
It's really interesting to be talking about separating yourself, like Twitter allows you to separate your identity a little bit from what you're saying, which is often leads to, you know, the worst parts of Twitter, but can also be empowering. That's interesting. Mm. Keelan, we became Twitter friends yesterday, so I haven't exactly followed you for that long, but...
I'm not funny on Twitter. Actually, I'm just like, oh, thanks for this review, la la la. You know, it's very boring. But weirdly, I mean, it's detrimental and beneficial, and I think, you know, having succumbed to ultimate cynicism about nepotism and everything else, especially in the art world, it is an access point. You know, there were people who wrote reviews, say, of my novel because they had followed me on Twitter for a while, and otherwise they wouldn't have discovered it. But the downsides obviously are enormous in that as a writer, you're expected to spend part of your week on social media. It is an unwritten rule, but it's very much expected, which means that, you know, for every, and often I'll get an email from someone doing, you know, an event saying, thanks for the one post you did about the event coming up, but, you know, it's really important that the authors bring their own audience. So if you can please, you know, do multiple posts. And I'm thinking, well, this is some talk I'm doing in like Essex. I don't have any followers in Essex, but you have to, you know, and so these are really micro things, but they do accumulate, because then you're spending time online, which is not good for your mental health. I don't have the stats to hand, but I mean, on a basic level, all of the kind of global studies that have been done on happiness concluded that comparison is one of the biggest hindrances to happiness, and you do see that. So when you're online, there's this kind of constant awareness of what you're not getting or what's not happening or what conversations are not taking place. And then on a kind of larger, stepping away from that kind of micro thing, on a larger level, the internet has facilitated globalization. And, you know, for example, outsourcing. So I worked for Google for a while, and afterwards I ran this little consultancy, and I kind of, for a brief amount of time, and earned, you know, four times what I earn now when I was like in my early 20s. But what I kind of discovered from all of that is that most kind of corporations and most small businesses and middle-sized businesses, basically across the spectrum, outsource work, you know, to everywhere from, you know, Bangladesh through to America. And, you know, so you're going from your, you know, your $2 an hour to your $15 an hour. And then you can kind of, you know, balance as to what kind of work that they're doing for you. And do you need it to be written in a certain way, or do you need just numbers? And it's absolutely brutal. I mean, the amount of industries where the work is almost 90% outsourced. And, you know, I found that kind of really disturbing, that so many people were making money by just being a face and just being salespeople for, you know, technical work that's being done by other people who are being paid less. So, you know, it's just so transparent that the value of the work is so far divorced from the work itself. And so that's all been facilitated by the internet, because, you know, you can't work with, you know, hundreds of contractors unless you're able to, you know, reach them that quickly. So as on a larger problem of globalization and the devaluing of labor, that's a huge thing. So on both sides of the spectrum, so on the super, super wealthy, at the moment in America, CEO's pay is 200 times that of your median worker in any institute, not the lowest level, the median. You know, 40 years ago, that statistic was 30 to 1. So it was still bad, but it's much, much higher, you know, in the most globalized culture. and that transfers. So, for example, at the moment, if I have my numbers right, in Japan, the CEO to median worker stat is 17 to 1. And so that probably has been changing a lot in the last few years because of America. Because if a CEO, if that's a new standard that you can expect millions in dollars in bonuses per year in one country because of a globalized economy, that then affects the disparity everywhere. So the internet equals globalization equals, you know, CEOs earning too much. Sorry about that. It's a bit of a tangent from your question. Sorry.
That's great. That actually leads me. No, I'll ask that question later. Fiona, many of your essays in your new book tackle topics of work, home, the economy, bodies, art, at least partly always through a personal millennial lens, because they are personal essays in part. There's one essay titled A Gravity Problem that hit me particularly deeply, and it was the same again when I read it yesterday. Do you mind just explaining this gravity problem as you write about it in relation to how someone in our generation has to wrestle with what you call the ghost woman, so the person who we might have been if we'd been given or even had some chance at the opportunities that we had set out when we wanted when we first set out?
Yeah. The ghost woman's an idea. The phrasing, I heard it in a podcast once she's in Melbourne now, a Melbourne writer and performer named Caitlin Plyley, who also lives with disability and has a podcast where she speaks to young people who live with chronic illness and disability that was very, very helpful to me. A lot of when I was kind of shifting my thinking from this idea that is kind of given to you, or that was given to me, I should say, when I first got sick, that if I just worked hard enough, tried everything, committed fully to the treatment I was being given, I would recover and pick up my life again, kind of where I'd left it off, and suddenly be able to do all of these things that I, by the time I was writing this book, hadn't been able to do for over a decade. I was in active treatment for my illness for 8 years. I tried every single kind of treatment there was, outpatient, day patient, inpatient, clinical trials, experimental trials. I did everything, and I wasn't getting anywhere. But kept trying because I just wanted to get better and to have a normal, ordinary, whatever you want to call it, life. This idea that I could pick things back up again. And Caitlin spoke about about being haunted by this idea of the ghost woman, who was the woman that she could have been had she not fallen ill. And I think tied into this kind of fighting I was doing was this idea that somehow I'd be able to catch up with that ghost woman who I could have been had I not gotten sick, the person that I might have been, the work that I might have done, the life that I might have had, the ease in the world that I might have had. It took me a long time to realise that a lot of what this book is about is grief and grieving for that idea. So that's sort of where the term comes from, but I started thinking too, at the same time, I did some work for a design company a few years ago, and we did a lot of website design and stuff like that. And there's a term in design, the gravity problem is a design concept. And the metaphor it draws on is if you're trying to solve a problem and the problem isn't actually solvable. So the metaphor is if you're riding a bike and you want to design a way to make that bike move faster, one of the problems is gravity, right? Gravity is slowing you down. But that's not a problem you can solve. It's a thing you have to work around. So that's how I tried to start thinking about my illness. This isn't a problem I can solve. It's a thing I've got to work around. And I've got to design or change other things in my world or in my thinking to get there, to be okay and to get all of those things back.
Yeah.
So I think you're sort of suggesting that...
Yeah, and like obviously you're talking about it in relation to your illness there, yeah. But I also think the subtext was there that it's bigger than that.
Yeah, that we have... And I think a lot of what I was grappling with in this book too is these inherited narratives that we have about the way our lives are supposed to be and the way our lives are supposed to look.
Yeah.
And those narratives and are outdated and don't fit to the realities of our lives these days, and we don't have new ways of talking or thinking about these yet.
Yeah.
How do you think about home? when, if you're like me, you've been living in share houses for 11 years, having to move house every 2 or 3 or 4 years because the landlord wants to sell the property. How do you think about a career when you're like me and you don't know what you're going to be doing in 5 weeks' term? Like, how do we think about narratives of our lives or structures for our lives when they're so unstable and we don't have these kind of easy ways of doing it, these easy ways of belonging or existing. That's not quite the right term, but I can't. Yeah.
No. Yeah. I saw you nodding, Killen, and like, I don't think anybody up here or anyone in our generation would pretend that our generation is the first to not have everything we wanted and meet all our goals. But do you feel like there's something particularly that's your experience that the world, our culture, sold you an idea of yourself that was the ideal and that okay. It was never
there's one,
possible?
There's one anecdote popping into my head and I have to tell it now because I have like a brain that can only cope with one thing at a time. I used to have... I was always interested, I think partly because my parents both made the... You know, they both... ran their own businesses from the start. My dad was an encyclopedia salesman and kind of sat down at certain point, and he was trying to also run this farm when his dad died young. And he was, you know, just in his car driving across the country nonstop. And he sat down with his friend one day and said, like, we can't keep doing this. We're both going to have heart attacks. And he actually had a triple bypass, like, 5 years later or something, but he did, they said, like, we need to figure out another way, and he said, what am I good at? You know, sales, okay, I'm good at, like, talking to people, so I'll do something where I am selling something, and I'll just be the person in front of people, and he said, what product should I do? Oh, well, computers are becoming a thing, maybe I'll do software, and so he ran a software company for 40 years, and also my mum ran her own business too, and still is working, and because of that background, I think, and they had 5 children, so there was a lot of patchworking to make us be all have a certain... They were trying to bring us all into the middle class, which is tough to do with 5 kids. And so from that background, I kind of gleaned that, you know, I might need to work really hard, and I started becoming interested in financial independence, and that became a kind of obsession later on, and I hence the job for Google and all of that. But I realised I would rather be poor and thoughtful, I asked Santa Claus, the first thing I asked him for was a sign that said shop around the back, because I wanted to stand at the end of the road with the sign, so that people would know I had like a shop, they could come in and buy things. And I did used to stand at the end of the road because my parents were both working. We were always on our own. And I do remember some really dodgy cars arriving. But anyway, some of the things I had in the shop were like branches of trees I had cut off and put into pots and said they were plants. And this kind of escalated then. And I had a stall in the market when I was, you know, 10. And I used to make these little pottery things and sell them, like be all cute and, you know, not pay for any license, but just squeeze myself in between other people's desks. And I sold things. And I saved over the course of, you know, 6 months, I saved 50 Irish pounds back when we had pounds. Our own pounds, and I remember having my mum and my sister and I. We made a trip to Dublin so that I could spend my 50 pounds. And mum was like, you can get whatever you want. And this was colossal. I'd never had this much money ever. And my sister was so jealous, but she just said, like, we're really close. And she was like, Keelan, please buy a wig. Please, like, we can both use it. We can be so many characters. It will go on and on. We can cut it if we get bored of it. And I was like, I was president of the Power Rangers Club in my school. There was only 1.5 other members, but still, it was, you know, a big part of my life. And so I really wanted this Power Rangers glove that went, go, go, Power Rangers, Mighty Morph. Anyway, and so I bought it, and much to my sister's, you know, sorrow, for £47. And then the January sales arrived 2 months later, and it was £9.
Oh,
so I learned pretty early on to be, you know, to not expect the best from the world. The world is a cruel, cruel place.
That's formed so much. I've just seen so much Power Rangers in your novel. Yeah. You know, it's just. we are going to open up for questions in a sec, so please get ready and chuck your hand up when they come around. I just did want to come back to climate change. You know, just that fun topic. Mm-hmm. But I do think what you said, Ev, is very true, that it is the one constant. And it would be my contention that it is an incredibly full-on psychological situation to be living in a world and growing up in a world where the messaging, both indirect and direct, is
that you're fucked.
We are making ourselves extinct. And I think the generations below us, it's even more full-on. And I've talked to teachers who teach children, and the stuff that's been talked about at 4 and 5 and 6 years old, and the ways they see the world, it's quite scary, I'd say. Is this something, like, how do you yourself, and obviously all of you, approach the world, and how do you find that affects you? How do you find meaning in all of these things when the kind of underlying subtext, the subtitle on the movie of your life is, soon it'll all be over anyway, and probably much sooner than we realise, if the scientists are correct, which I wouldn't
which
argue
they are.
Otherwise, exactly.
But Pauline Hanson says, no. I've made a lot of choices in my life, and my partner and I, like, we've made choices that, like, we're not going to have kids, we can't afford to do that, we don't want to be emotionally accountable to creating children that might end up seeing, you know, their whole world destroyed. Our aspirational wealth is aspiring to be able to live off of the grid, and to be able to have a self-sustaining home one day. So I've adapted personal desires and personal choices around those sorts of goals, expecting that future. I have been involved in a lot of activism around climate change. I actually occupied Malcolm Turnbull's private beach when he was Prime Minister, with a number of Pacific Islander Indigenous climate warriors. So I am involved. I am involved with that as well. But I kind of have a little bit of a cultural and spiritual cop-out here, where I'm perfectly fine with the land losing the people on it, because I do believe in the continuity of the land. And, like, whatever, people, when are we even that great? I'm not even sure. So if we're lost from the land, I still think that the land will survive, and that that's more important than the humans on it personally.
Yeah, and that the narrative is that not that we're necessarily creating our own extinction, but the land is also helping that, recognizing that we perhaps don't belong
punishment
here anymore.
You know, well, yeah, you did wrong. You did the wrong thing. Now you're getting punished for it. So don't complain. You know, yeah.
Did either of you want to jump in?
But just, yeah, I guess on that, you know, the less action we take now, the more culture we'll lose. My partner is an environmental scientist, so, like, it's an everyday. Like, it was 26 degrees in the 15th of April in The Hague, where I live, and we were just sat in outside some cafe, and he just was like, started weeping. And it is difficult. It's very difficult to countenance. Sorry, I'm getting a bit Greta Thunberg on it, but I think the way to think about it is, there are already going to be costs, and now there's a chance to limit those costs, and if we don't, how can we live with ourselves? So, I mean, if there's anyone in the room who's been thinking about stopping eating meat, like, do it, just, like, try maybe just once a week eating meat, because
unless
that's,
you're recovering anorexic, in which case don't do it.
Let's say that's fair enough. it's the science of there was a huge report that said the number one thing you can do if you're trying to figure out whether it's that you should eat local food or whether you should fly less, the number one thing you can do is eat less meat and dairy, just less meat and dairy, because it affects land and it affects any.
Also, hold corporations accountable for the massive destruction that they're causing to our environment. If you get the opportunity to do that as well.
Yeah. Carbon tax.
Also,
carbon tax would be good. Yeah, individuals can do a lot, but we know that it is the corporations and the
government.
Because, I mean,
the sci-fi thing, like, really, with the scientist partner, it gets sci-fi-ish in the sense that they do think of the Earth as being a system that will self-correct, but what will get lost in the meantime is cultures. And how many cultures? You know, it's the same as biodiversity, you know. Do you value cultures? And so that's kind of the sci-fi level. You know, human society will survive. We're incredibly adaptable, and, you know, and we've had a lot of different forms over the centuries.
Yep.
But what form do you want to take, and what do you want to try and protect? And that should not be all white, all Norway-based peoples.
Yes, no. Phew. I've got so much more I want to ask, but I want to throw it out to you all. So if you do have a question, please just throw your hand in the air. And we have some microphones at the back, I do believe, in the person in yellow. So Thank you. I would just ask if you can please make sure it's a question and as brief as you possibly can.
Yes, look, you've all described your lives as millennials, and the description is a very fragmented lives and fragmented days. And I wonder whether that's affecting you as writers, what choices you make, because it seems to me that it's very hard to find time these days to read a novel or even write a novel. So do you think there'll be less novel writing out of you and others and more poetry writing or more essay writing or more tweet writing rather than, say, novels?
I've actually gone in the opposite direction. I started as a poet and then I started writing essays, and I think I started writing a novel recently, which is incidentally is about a millennial who decides that the only way she's going to be able to buy a house is to kill her parents and get her inheritance early, and it's so much fun. So much fun. I can't tell you how fun it is to be writing something that makes you giggle rather than something that makes you stare at your computer and want to cry. The way I do it is by getting up early and I write in the mornings when my brain is still fresh and then do everything else that I have to do after that. And that's just what works for me. But I've had to learn how to do that and be very disciplined about it. But that's my approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think those crafts and those forms are really going to be adaptable to the lifestyles people can get. And that's a fragmented thing. You can't plan, oh, well, maybe this year I'll be my year to write my novel. You know, you never really know that. But I do really think that we're seeing, through a number of different circumstances, we're seeing a real increase in different forms of poetics, like performance poetry. Mm-hmm. And that's having a number of different functions, and it's coming from places where, like, maybe, you know, people who don't often get the opportunity to be articulating their experiences or feeling really called to these particular forms. And also the ease and the quickness of them being shared and distributed around the world is really appealing. So that kind of temporality is really shifting, I think, in terms of the conventional publishing process, where a lot of your time as a writer gets caught up with the admin and not actually with the production of the work. So that's something that I think, like, you know, a lot of people, I hope, are going to be taking those forms more seriously and giving them a little bit more respect, because those conditions just have changed, and then that's a great way of having art which responds to those changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, and there's also the generations are having different responses. So poetry has had a huge, big resurgence recently. You know, there's a big increase in readership of poetry, which is amazing and wonderful, and makes a lot of sense in terms of when it is a difficult time for young people to process, you know, what they need to do with their lives and how they can cope with having $120,000 of student debt and what, you know, all of the things that they're coping with. It makes sense, because poetry is philosophy. You know, it's as close as an everyday philosophy as you get. I think far more people read poetry for philosophy than they read philosophy texts. And so often, you know, when there are crises, you know, people kind of turn to poetry. I mean, that's certainly true of Ireland's history. And we have a poet president at the moment, which I think
is wonderful.
Is like really, you know.
We do not. But, yeah.
Sorry for you. but and then I think, though, what may happen with the next generation is maybe, in theoretically, there could be a return to the novel as a long form medium that they can commit to in response, because you always have these waves, you know, there's waves of too much content on Netflix, too many things to check through, too many different types of media, and the novel is kind of a relaxing mode, and it's also immersive, and I think it might be something that people look to in order to, you know, calibrate their lives again and find some, you know, find one place to be in for a while, hopefully.
Mm. Thanks. I think we have time for at least one more. So are there any other hands up?
There was someone over here before.
Is there someone here? Yeah, there's one at the back. I can see one just there. Thank you.
Hi. If I heard you correctly in the beginning, you mentioned how you have to divorce yourself in a way from the earlier generation, but we're in the same boat. And I was just wondering what thoughts you have about creating some sort of symbiosis, you know, the people who are generation before you who have done the same thing, wanting to change, been acting on climate change and being affected by the internet and having to operate in that sort of environment. So my question is, what sort of venues do you see for this sort of interchange? Because it will be more powerful. You don't have to just write to describe what's going on. Maybe there'll be solutions.
Okay. I can jump in on that because I've worked a lot, particularly I think when we're coming from not just Aboriginal models but global Indigenous models. We have we place a really central importance on our elders, and the logic of this is that you pay your respects and your honouring to your elders while you are making way for those who are coming next. And one day you'll be looked after, but you're not the priority right now because you have the strength and the time to be able and the energy to be able to do that. So I spend a lot of time trying to learn from those older people who have come. And, you know, when we're talking about climate change, Aboriginal people, we have already lived through this. We have lived and we have survived ice ages on this coast alone. You know, we have lived through the apocalypse of our land being taken from us and our traditional ways of looking after that land being removed from our power. And we can only learn from those unbroken lines of oral history and oral testimony to be caring for those people who have suffered through very different conditions than we have, and to be honouring what they have given to us. But, you know, we do have to think about who's coming next as well, as our elders did for us. So I think the best way of us honouring and respecting people who have been doing that work is giving them the chance to rest if they want, knowing that they can trust us to care for that in the future. You know, showing them that they've done what they needed to do and that we still have so much to learn from them, but that they can rest, you know, I think is really crucial. Mm. Woo!
Did you have anything on that?
I think that's a great answer.
I think you're right. We do have time for one more quick one, if there's someone out there. There's a lady just... Oh, you've got one there. Do you have somebody? Thank you. It's hard to see, sorry, up here. We've got the spotlight.
Lights.
I think we're going over here, yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
I feel like the term millennial can define me at times, but also feel like a bit of a criticism. And I was just wondering whether you think the term is helpful or not.
So the question was, it could be about criticism and...
Yeah, that's what's frustrating about it, right?
It is,
an
right?
annoying term, but I guess they all are. You wouldn't want to be called a baby boomer either, or Gen X or Gen Y, you know, or Gen Z. It's all a bit annoying. I think if we just maybe talked, you know, about it in terms of the years or something like that, it might be more useful. But you're right, comes with a critical association. It's also nobody chose to be called that, so it never feels good when people start telling you, you know, what you are.
Do you know how I like to think about this? I found out that there was a generation that called themselves the last generation. It was kind of how they were defined, and that was about halfway through the 19th century.
What was that?
That they were just like, we're going to be the last generation because the world is ending, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you know, from our point of view now, that seems completely and utterly ridiculous.
We're the last generation.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. So that kind of idea that these are just sort of weird, nebulous concepts that make sense for some people and don't for others, but are kind of arbitrary. I don't actually put that much stock in it, and I say that right at the end of a session where we've been talking about exactly the opposite.
But I think it says a lot that millennial is kind of a belittling term. Mm. And it's also kind of coinciding with, you know, a generation of people who are trying to be a little bit conscientious. You know, that's a typical thing in history. Your children are always more conscientious than you. That's why they're so annoying. and that's fine. That's, you know, par for the course. I suppose we're straddling the generations at the moment where you're still made to feel slightly awkward if you ask for anything, you know, particular. If you ask for somebody to refer to you, as a non-binary gender, or if you ask people to have vegan food on the platter, you know, those things they see as frustrating, and as demanding, when in fact a lot of those choices are being made in order to try and make other people feel accommodated and not reduced to their genitalia or to try and save the planet or whatever else. So it's been a negative connotation, but unfairly.
Yes, I'm afraid we're out of time. Before anything, I do want to say, I did say we don't have a poet prime minister, but he did come up with the line, if you have a go, you'll get a go.
No.
So maybe he is our he is a bard at heart. Can you please all join me in thanking these panellists?
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.